From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the November 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Women at War. This month, to coincide with the Wren's centenary, we look at women in both wars. We find out about a new exhibition at Bletchley Park and why knitters have been sending in items from around the world. Dr. Jim Beach sheds light on the hush wax in World War I, and Claire Mully tells us about the women who flew for Hitler. But first, Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, tells us why women were needed for the war effort. Let's go back to your special period of expertise, the First World War. What were women doing 100 years ago? So let's say from the beginning of the war up to 1917.
Well, women were involved on the Western Front right from the beginning of the war because the army was using nurses, female nurses, in military hospitals. And they go back to the Crimea and Florence Nightingale originally, but the organisation that still exists, the Queen Alexandra's Nursing Corps, was founded in 1902 during the Boer War, or shortly after Boer War, and then went on to provide personnel in the First World War. On the civilian side in the UK, you have women increasingly involved in the munitions industry from really 1915 onwards. There's a big campaign to get women involved in supporting the war from 1914, but it takes a little while for things to sort themselves out, for people to actually get jobs.
So it's on a voluntary basis at that stage. That's the impression I have about nursing, at least, is that
yes,
girls from good homes would go and volunteer to do their bit.
There were two sort of strands to it. There was the first aid nursing yeomanry, who were the posh lady volunteers, and there was the Queen Alexandra's, who were the full-time army nurses. And there was a certain amount of friction between the two because the army nurses thought that the posh girls didn't know what they were doing and got all the attention and stuff. Interestingly, in 1914, the women's suffrage movement, they actually suspend operations. They've been quite active in the years leading up to 1914, but the Pankhursts decided that it might be considered unpatriotic to be protesting on the streets when the war was going on. So they got behind the war effort, but they also switched their attentions to trying to get women more involved in the workplace to support the war. And they had a big march in London campaigning for women to be used. And Lloyd George, who subsequently became Minister of Munitions, was very much behind that project.
Well, it's quite apt to the desire for driving equality to say we can contribute to this, isn't it?
Absolutely. And both world wars contribute significantly to the sort of women's equality process because women move into all sorts of lines of work that previously might have been blocked to them. I mean, during the First World War, they play football. There's a women's football league.
Did it keep going after
the
First
World War? No, it didn't.
Oh, that's a shame.
The problem with a lot of this is in 1918, women more or less get the sack. And the process has to be started again in 1939.
What about the military?
Well, you have female nurses already, as I say, and then later in the war, it's clear that women can be used in non-combat roles in all of the armed services. So the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, which is the women in the army, that starts up in 1917. And the Royal Navy follows suit with the Women's Royal Naval Service, the WRENS, which is what we're commemorating today.
We might take equality to the degree that it exists now, somewhat for granted. The time we live in is vastly different, though, than it was 100 years ago. But look at the previous 100 years before that. Would as much progress have been made then, or had things been the same for a long time in terms of what was expected of women?
I think things had been the same for a long time. The assumption that people make, which is incorrect, is that in 1914, not very many women had jobs. Prior to the First World War, lots of women had jobs, and particularly working-class women. They had no choice. They needed, in order to feed their families, they needed to work. But it's the types of jobs people do. In the latter 19th century, huge numbers of women are employed in domestic service, for example, as servants in people's houses. Ironically, the Ministry of Labour doesn't consider that to be employment. So those women don't appear in the official statistics prior to 1914. There are large numbers of women also in the north of England working in the textile industry. So woolen mills, cotton mills, those industries employ large numbers of women as well. One of the ironies of 1914 is there is a crash in the textile trade as a consequence of the war. And so large numbers of women become unemployed in August 1914, and they are then readily available for employment in the war industries later on.
And was it clear at the beginning of the war that that amount of man or woman power would be needed? Because I get the impression from the Second World War more that it was from the get-go a huge national endeavour in which everybody had to play their part. Was it comparable in that way in the first? Was it something viewed by many as just something that was happening to other people and that would be over with? And
well, you have two schools of thought. You have the sort of the over by Christmas school of thought that the war won't last very long at all. And on the other hand, you have Lord Kitchener, for example, who takes the view that it's going to be a much longer and harder struggle than people think. So there is definitely a school of thought amongst sort of the powers that be that the war could very well last for a long time. And so the employment of women and the replacement of men by women in various roles throughout society, from bus driving to munitions manufacture, is a considered position. But it's not the same as equality. Giving a woman a man's job doesn't make her equal to the man in the First World War, because typically women are given men's jobs for which they are paid less. And in all cases, they would be supervised by men. In munitions work, for example, lathe turning operations, they had an arrangement which was called setting up, where the woman wasn't considered competent to put the billet of metal in the machine and configure it to do the job.
To stand back and watch a man do it.
She would have to stand back and watch a man set up the task for her, and then he would get a lump of her wages to cover for the work he'd done on her behalf. And then she would then do the task. And then when she'd finished, a man would come along and check it and set the next task.
Wow.
And so you can't think of it as women becoming equal in any sense. They are being given male jobs, but they are still very much working in a male-dominated environment.
And only because the men were unavailable.
Yes.
They're all being sent off
and
to fight.
And you look in 1918, as soon as the men become available again, and the munitions industry in particular, that there's no longer a requirement for millions of shells every month. Those women are sacked more or less immediately, even in industries that continue after 1918. And the government has an armaments industry that continues into the 1920s. The women that have been employed are fired straight away, and they go back to being basically male industries.
With the creation of the Wrens and the other jobs that women went into specifically for the war effort in the First World War, were any of those continued in military terms after that war was over?
No, they weren't. It was similar to women in the other wartime industries. The Wrens are abolished, and it's only in 1939, when the Second World War starts, that they realise they have to recreate these institutions again. And we're commemorating 100 years of the Wrens, because they were re-established as Wrens again in 1939. The WAC, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, wasn't recreated. You get a new organisation, which is the ATS, that was created in the Second World War.
The Queen joined, didn't she?
The Queen was in the ATS, yes. Which is ironic, because the ATS was considered the least socially respectable of the women's services.
She was very much of the people. Of course, she was only Princess Elizabeth then, wasn't she?
The most glamorous one to be in was the WAFs, because that had associations with high technology and flying. The Wrens, of course, considered themselves to be an elite, just in their own minds. I don't think anyone else necessarily thought so, but that's how the Navy does business. So.
The Wrentenary marks 100 years since the establishment of the Women's Royal Naval Service. That anniversary is being celebrated with a new pop-up exhibition at Bletchley Park. I had a chat with the exhibition's manager, Erica Munro.
What have you learned in your research about the Wrens that stands out in your mind for you?
I've read an enormous amount of individual accounts from various Wrens about their work, both at Bletchley Park and for Bletchley Park. Not all Wrens that we consider that were working in signals intelligence at Bletchley Park were actually based here at the site. There was a huge number of Wrens involved both in the bomb outstations outside the Bletchley Park site and in the Y service as well, all of their work still a huge and valuable contribution to the work that Bletchley itself was doing.
So for the uninitiated, the Wire service is...
the wireless intercept service. So listening stations, yeah. Basically, intercepting voice and encrypted messages and sending that on to Bletchley Park so that the codebreakers could...
So statistically, if you meet a World War II Wren, she's much more likely to have been somewhere that wasn't physically here at Bletchley Park. Just there were so many more at these other places, weren't there?
Certainly, if you're talking about the people who were here at the end of the war, yes. I mean, there were, even at Bletchley Park itself, the majority of people here were women and the majority of those women were Wrens. So Wrens did play a really large role at Bletchley itself, but there were a lot more Wrens feeding into the work of Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Wrens weren't here right at the start, I should say that as well. In 1941, there were just a handful, fewer than 10 Wrens on site. By 1945, say by the end of the war, that was 2,600 or so Wrens were here. Now, if you think that those weren't the same women necessarily throughout that period of time, we're talking thousands of women were working for the Bletchley Park effort during the Second World War in the Women's Royal Naval Service. As I say, there was a really wide range of roles that they did. Some were really high flyers. They were responsible for translating decrypted messages, organising captured documents, for example, that were based here at Bletchley for analysis. But there were also a large number of women who were maybe more sort of clerical and support roles, who didn't have that bigger understanding of what they were doing, but knew that they were contributing to a larger cause. It's been really interesting, certainly, listening to oral history testimony from some of the Wrens who are remembering when they, for example, learned Japanese in order to better understand the work that they were doing. Some women don't really have a sort of command of fluent Japanese, but they can remember specific terms or recognise specific characters, which brings it all back to them again. And that was a real joy to hear about and to read about. In the other research that we've been doing, there have been some Wrens that have said that their work was incredibly tedious, incredibly boring, particularly the women operating machinery. Now, a large number of Wrens working for Bletchley Park were operating bomb machines, for example, at outstations, Colossus machines here at Bletchley Park, Hollerith machines, other code-breaking equipment, and that required a large amount of manpower or womanpower and a lot of patience, I would say. A lot of the work seems to have been repetitive, and there may have not been the broader understanding of the use of the output of that work, but certainly it was hard work, and they knew that they were a small cogs in a really large and important machine.
You're from a naval family yourself.
Yes, I am.
Is there a type that seems to have been drawn to the Navy, as far as you can tell from your research?
It's actually quite an interesting question. There seems to, from my research, have been a really wide range of women. Some women just wanted to go to sea and ended up at
Landlocked
Eastcote and Stanmore. Yeah, yeah. Whereas some women wanted to do their bit. Some women naturally came from naval backgrounds or were chosen because of their linguistic skills, or that was the direction they were going to go for anyway. Being from a naval family myself and knowing a lot of present day Wrens, it's difficult to say that there's a particular type that was either chosen to work at Bletchley or that's currently in the Navy. It's a really diverse group of women that I know, certainly now. And I would say during the Second World War, the Wrens that were here were either chosen because they wanted to do something secret, but they weren't able to be told what that was, or they were chosen because of their specific abilities in terms of things like mathematics or languages.
And so now, is it still a separate unit for women?
No, it's all combined. The women in the Royal Navy that I know now still refer to themselves as Wrens.
You must have had, as you say, a vast array of stories. How did you begin to boil that down and decide what was going to go on a small amount of panel space for this pop-up exhibition?
As you say, the pop-up exhibition is really small, and we were faced with a choice of either trying to make it entirely about facts and figures, or to make it about kind of mishmash of lots of different stories and a combination of lots of personal opinions, or a crossover of the two. And because of the limited amount of space that we've got, we chose to present a certain number of facts and bits of information, the number of Wrens that served in the various sections, for example, the dates that Wrens were here. We have a map that shows the buildings on site that Wrens were working in as well. And I think it will surprise a lot of people, certainly those who visit under the misconception that there were sort of woolens wearing
Oxbridge
types, yeah, working here. I think that they'll be very surprised about how widely spread the Wrens were across the site and the variety of work that they actually did as well. There's also a misconception that wrens were sort of working in the grunt jobs. You know, they were blindly operating machinery and didn't understand what they were doing. And that's also proven not to be the case. There were some wrens in very high positions, as well as some wrens working in roles that were more monotonous and that didn't require quite as much, say, understanding of the code-breaking aspect of things.
But they were still, I would say, hand-picked, weren't they? Because they'd go to basic training quite often at Tullyhewan Castle up in the wilds of Scotland, and they would be hand-picked out from the basic training process, and they knew not why or how.
Yes.
But I think there must have been an intelligence about them that shone through.
Yes.
And maybe an integrity.
Exactly. Or an application.
To do with the secrecy. That must maybe have been part of it. They maybe weren't spotted as being gossipy.
I think that's right.
It may have been some of their interpersonal behaviour that was noticed. And it may have been to do with, you say, how they applied themselves to things. When you've been scrubbing floors and cleaning toilets as part of your basic training, it'd be hard to know where that was spotted.
It's true, actually. Certainly the basic training seems to have been very basic
very
and
basic.
Sort of brought everybody together at a particular level.
Well, it's that classic military basic training where they strip it right down to the basics and see what you're made of, don't they?
Yes, exactly.
What you will put up with, I think. What's your favourite element of this exhibition? What's the bit that makes you most proud that you've done it?
I think it's the simplicity of the exhibition. It's a fairly small display, but we've put it really prominently in the admissions block. And by focusing on five kind of key areas where wrens were working at and for Bletchley Park, we've been able to give a real snapshot of that. We've not had the room to go into very much detail. That's been a real pity. But obviously, we wanted to keep it in a sense that people would understand. It's actually a really nice introduction to the site. If you see this display and then you start going around the Bletchley Park site on your visit, it sort of introduces the wrens to you before you see the site and puts it all into a bit of context. You can start imagining wrens on the site. And that's been a real pleasure to do because we didn't have the opportunity to do that quite as much before. The Wren Centenary has given us the possibility to focus on the wrens and their contribution and lead people into their visit with that in mind, just as we would for the ATS and the WAF as well and their centenaries. But with the wrens, it means that their contribution isn't overlooked, particularly in their centenary year. We look at five key areas, the Newmanry, where the Colossus and Heath Robinson machines were being used, the naval section, with a huge number of wrens, really young wrens as well, the vast majority of them aged between 17 and 20. The Y service, outside of the walls of Bletchley Park, delivering intercepted messages back to Bletchley, and also the bomb out stations. But one thing I was really pleased for us to also include was support services. So there was a wren's cafeteria here at Bletchley Park, serving at its peak up to 1,000 meals a day. It was run by wrens. There was some discussion, do we really want to be putting in a story about women cooking? It seems a little bit old-fashioned, but actually it's an aspect that does get overlooked because of the code-breaking prominence of the story.
It was happening. It was an important part of it.
Absolutely.
These people didn't eat. They didn't work.
Well, exactly. And admittedly, the food, it seems, was pretty terrible. But I don't think that's changed much from my understanding as well to the modern day Navy.
Are you hoping to drag some of your naval friends here to look at this?
I think some of my naval friends are definitely going to come here anyway to look at this. They're pretty excited about it.
Knit One, Post One has been running at Bletchley Park for a few months now. Donations of handmade vintage knitwear will be used to bring the huts and blocks to life. Exhibitions assistant Emma Trelevin has been running the project and she's making her Bletchley Park podcast debut.
Now, first of all, where did the idea for Knit One, Post One come from?
It was very much inspired by what we have as set dressing around the site. So we use kind of personal items like cardigans, handbags and that sort of thing in places like the huts and the mansion.
I love the cups of tea that have been finished.
Yeah.
It's quite ghostly. It looks like someone's just walked away.
Well, exactly. It's that is kind of the point, is that everyone just stood up and walked away in February 1941. But we wanted to put very kind of personal items in to remind people that, you know, these are all a huge wide variety of individuals working here, from service people to civilians, huge variety. So it started off where our curator, Fiona, asked if we kind of any more kind of spare knitwear pieces that we could put around the site in winter. And we realized we had a few, but they weren't quite enough for what we wanted to do. We like to change it up seasonally a little bit and make it, you know, a bit different every year. And so we kind of looked into the possibility of having people knit things for us from original 1940s patterns. So maintaining the rest of the accuracy level that we have around the rest of the site, but, you know, having things that the public can see and interact with.
How rare are original 1940s knitting patterns then?
The patterns themselves aren't that rare. You can get them in lots of charity shops, lots of places around. A lot of people's grandparents still have them. There's actually a huge amount available online for free, which is what we actually suggested to our knitters when we put our call out saying, here's some, you know, resources that don't cost anything. The actual knits themselves are really, really tough to find. So this is kind of a way that we can still get the accuracy and get these beautiful, beautiful, very, you know, period pieces made, but without having to, you know, trawl through vintage shops all around the country.
So you got quite a good response then?
Oh, we got a phenomenal response. Hundreds of people from all over the world, you know, from kids to older ladies to everybody really just wanted to get involved. It was incredible. You know, we had things getting posted to us from as far away as kind of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the States, all over Europe, all over the British Isles, everywhere.
So how many did you end up with?
We ended up with over 200 things in the end, ranging in size and complexity. So from sweaters, cardigans, down to kind of simple kind of mittens and hats and that sort of thing. A lot of service comforts, which is very exciting for us to see. So we had over 150 people take the time to knit us something from scratch from a 40s pattern and then post it to us.
That's wonderful. What's a service comfort?
There was kind of quite a big thing in the First World War and the Second World War of knitting patterns being published for people in the armed forces to wear. So if you wanted to do something nice for, you know, your loved one who was abroad somewhere or serving somewhere, you could knit them a scarf or a pair of gloves or a pair of mittens or a hat. But these were all things that went with uniform regulation. So things that you could actually wear, because, you know, you imagine if you knit your sister who's in the ATS a fluffy pink jumper, she's not really going to be able to wear it with her uniform. So we got some really, really interesting things from, you know, kind of naval service comforts books and army ones for, you know, to represent the people that were in the services here, for men and women.
People's dedication to detail must have been something that impressed you out of all this.
Oh, hugely so. Yeah, we didn't ask that people use vintage yarn because finding 1940s yarn is, like the sweaters, really, really difficult. But some people managed it. Some people actually went and sourced proper authentic yarn, checked, you know, color schemes with what would have been accurate, everything, and then, yeah, knit the patterns. So we got some incredibly detailed things. We thought we were going to maybe, you know, get 10 jumpers and a couple pairs of mittens. But yeah, it's just been this kind of amazing worldwide response.
So tell me a bit about what you'll be doing with them, how they'll be used and displayed.
Originally, we just were planning on using them for set dressing, so to put out, you know, around the huts and through the mansion and areas like that. But because we had so many people that were so generous with their time, we have far more than we're going to be able to use in the immediate future. So we actually opened up the kind of call to other departments here at Bletchley. So the learning team ended up with quite a few items that they are going to be using in outreach programs and things like that. And we also kind of gave the events team here a collection to be using for things like our 1940s weekends. So staff and volunteers can actually borrow items if they feel like dressing up and getting into the spirit of the event. They've got something that is very accurate and really gorgeous, actually, to wear.
Do you walk away from this project then feeling that you've got to know Bletchley's audience a little bit?
I do, yeah. A lot of people with family history involvements, a lot of people with other interests, a lot of people that, you know, I don't think that we realised were very interested in this place and the social history aspect of this place, as well as the early computing and the mathematics and, you know, just the amazing story that, you know, we're lucky enough to have to talk about so often. But yeah, huge different variety of people. Yeah, it's been great.
Has it led you to think on what else you might ask people to do?
It's a bit of a process. So we've gotten these objects, which is excellent, but we still have to freeze them for conservation purposes. We still have to sew labels with numbers into them. We have to enter them into our collections management database. So we're still kind of doing enough of the work on this project and then getting them out and showing to the public and doing things like that. It'll definitely make the huts even prettier than they already are. I'm really, really excited to be putting them out. But yeah, as soon as we kind of complete the project, so to speak, then we'll definitely be thinking of how we can harness that energy that so many people have.
The Women's Army Auxiliary Corps were recruited to take the place of men during World War I. One job taken up by the WACS was strictly hush-hush. Dr. Jim Beach from the University of Northampton has been doing some digging into the story of the hush-WACS and he shared some of his insights with our very own podcast producer, Mark Cotton.
You've been investigating something that's, in a way, linked back to the ancestors of Bletchley Park, haven't you?
Yes, I mean, SIGINT existed a long time before the Second World War, and during the First World War, SIGINT is fairly prominent as an intelligence source, changes quite a lot during the war, and this year is the centenary of the use of a group of women called the Hushwacks, or became known as the Hushwacks, in a code-breaking capacity with the British Expeditionary Force in France.
How were they set up? Why were they set up?
Okay, well, I think there's a couple of things here. First of all, the prominence of, for example, Room 40 and the sort of SIGINT activities that are going on in Room 40 and MI1B in London. Because they're working at the strategic level and doing quite significant things in terms of things like the Zimmermann telegram, etc., they have quite rightly been much more prominent in the histories that have been written ever since. Now, within Room 40, within MI1B, there are women working in those offices in different capacities. And we've known about them for a while, and they are usually mentioned in those histories. I suppose there's a sort of less glamorous part of SIGINT, which is that which is happening at a lower level. If we're looking at sort of Room 40 and we're looking at MI1B, they're going after sort of, you know, high-level encryption systems that the Germans have. They're going after sort of strategic-level messages, diplomatic traffic, this sort of thing. But, you know, out on the battlefronts, you've got lower-level encryption systems being used by the German army and by Britain's other enemies in other theatres. And they're less sophisticated as a sort of cryptographic challenge, but the volume of traffic is very high. And so you develop a sort of signals intelligence capacity to deal with that. And what we see in 1917 is a group of women who are deployed out to France in uniform to assist in that process. I wouldn't want to give the impression that this wasn't happening before their arrival. They become part of the team rather than this being a sort of sudden thing. You know, they've been going after the lower level German encryption systems for many years before that point.
I guess they needed just more staff, didn't they, at that point? Was this because wireless was becoming more widespread?
Yes. I mean, if we look at German frontline communications on the Western Front, one of the things that happens is in 1916, the Germans start to move away from the use of telephone systems and sort of, you know, ground-based wire systems to wireless. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. One aspect is that those trench telephones, if you like, if we call them that, can be intercepted. And there is a whole sort of subsection of the sort of British intelligence effort which is directed at that. Then in 1916, also what is happening is that the Germans are also discovering that sort of telephone-based systems don't survive very long in battlefield situation, particularly with the Allies using huge amounts of artillery fire. So wireless helps you get over that problem. You're no longer having to continually repair the lines. There's also an issue for the Germans, which is because of the blockade, they must use their copper wisely. And so it's much more efficient in terms of your scarce metal resources to use wireless. So if you like, a wireless set is a much more efficient use of resources. It's instantaneous communication. It's less vulnerable to sustained bombardments if you're able to sort of put it down. I mean, there is always a problem with trench wireless that you still have to get the aerial up, and that is still vulnerable. So we see the Germans moving more towards wireless. They've been using wireless for a while as well in their aircraft, in terms of aircraft spotting for artillery and that sort of things. So as the Germans move towards wireless and the volume of German wireless traffic mushrooms, what we see in the sort of latter half of 1916 and then into 1917 is that the British Expeditionary Force starts to build up a collection capability in terms of intercept stations, in terms of the individuals to sort of just even just gather the traffic. And then with the Germans using various codes and ciphers, what we then need is a means of sort of going after those codes and ciphers. Now, you have MI1B back in the War Office, but they've got a lot on anyway. Yeah. MI1E in the War Office has also got a lot on in terms of the Zeppelins and the air defence dimension. So what emerges is an organisation called IEC, I brackets E followed by a C, which is a sort of small code-breaking bureau, which is based in France, initially based in the town of Saint-Omer. And initially, from what we say, and one of the nice things is that the Hushwacks memoirs give us an insight into what is going on there. You have sort of various eclectic officers and NCOs who are attacking the various German encryption systems. But as you said, the sheer weight of work means that they need more manpower. So the problem for the British Army in 1917, and this this is part of the reason why the WACS, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, is formed in 1917, is that there aren't enough men. The WACS are formed with the idea that you can replace men in jobs at home or in the rear areas, and that then frees them up to go and be frontline soldiers. So, for example, large numbers of WACS are used as telephone exchange operators, that sort of thing. I would strongly recommend the book by Samantha Philo Gill, recently published on the centenary of the establishment of the WACS, where she unpacks all this in great, great detail. So there's this sort of general process of bringing women in to replace men in non-combatant jobs so that you can then release men to the front. Although the documentary record is pretty fragmentary, what I think we're seeing is GHQ Intelligence, who are the organisation which is running intelligence on the Western Front, they need more bodies in the code-breaking bureau. They know that if they ask for more men, they'll be told no. But if they ask for women, they have a chance of then increasing the numbers. And given the sort of the intensity and volume of the work, you can sort of see in the sort of the, if you like, the sort of the easy bureaucratic solution is to ask for some WACS who then come in. And they arrive in September 1917 and get to work. So if we look at the women who are working in the code-breaking bureaus in London, we can see by their sort of job descriptions that they are very much sort of auxiliary staff. Yeah. What I think we're looking at with the Hush WACS, and again, you know, we haven't got a smoking gun here. This is sort of reading, taking the memoirs, cross-referencing that with the job descriptions and what else we know about the way in which the men are being used. I think they're on a par with the men. Now, what we can see, initially at least, they are assisting rather than leading that process. And that, of course, is in part because they were going into an existing organisation. Yeah. What we also see, and this is some of the problems in terms of the process of recruitment and trying to get the right people to the jobs, but some of these hushwacks, at least two of them, probably maybe three, show quite a lot of aptitude for this work. And I think, you know, again, there's no definitive source where we can say they were working on a par with the men, but I think we can imply that from the fact that at least two of them are taken and then in 1919 go and actually work in MI1B and are sort of, you know, elevated to the next level. But as with all of these things, the sources are fragmentary. You can read them in many different ways.
You've had some help with this, haven't you? But you've been working on this quite a while, haven't you?
Yes. We've known about the existence of the Hush WACS for quite a while. We've had the two memoirs have been available in the National Army Museum and the Imperial War Museum for quite a few years. The Hush WACS themselves appear in the establishment tables for the Intelligence Corps, which have been available for many, many years. And, you know, I think it's fair to say, and I'm guilty of this as well, is that we've sort of always known that they were there. And, you know, we've mentioned them a lot. You know, they usually get sort of name checked in sort of histories of the subject. But what surprised me when the centenary was coming along and the sort of the idea sort of formed to go and look in more detail was that nobody had really sort of pulled things together.
It takes something like that to give it a nudge, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think had it not been for the centenary, had it not been for discussions with Joyce Hutton, the archivist at the Military Intelligence Museum, and we just sort of, you know, we got a conversation going and it's sort of like, you know, would it be possible to find out more about these Hush WACS? And you then run into the difficulties of very fragmentary evidence on the intelligence side, but also you have problems with the personnel records for the WACS in that not all of them survive. So to begin with, we were sort of struggling, you know, how would we break into this?
We struggle with our investigations, which are 75 years old. You're going another generation before that, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think you also have to remember that particularly with First World War records is the impact of the Luftwaffe. For anything related to the War Office archive, or the War Office storage of documents was out of Whitehall in 1940. It's then hit by a German incendiary bomb and large chunks of it are lost. I mean, you know, full credit to the National Archives in that they have, you know, the burnt documents, you know, those that have survived have been digitized and you can use that to sort of research for individuals. But, you know, there are quite a lot of big blanks because clearly, you know, if you're interested in a particular group and they happen to be close to the center of that fire, then the chances of finding any of them are going to be pretty limited. So you're then looking at I'm at the moment involved in a project where we're looking at the men of the intelligence corps, and you're then sort of trying to get lucky in finding people who've transferred out, whose files have survived, that sort of thing. So you're and then you're trying to read back, and so it's trying to assemble a jigsaw when you know there are only half the pieces in the box.
And you possibly don't have the picture from the front of the box either.
Yeah. Or I suppose in some ways as well, and this is always a problem with history, is that you have the sort of the established view. So everyone, you know, you sort of think that that's the picture on the box of the jigsaw. But then as you start to, you know, put the pieces together, actually the old picture doesn't look right.
It's actually taken from a different angle.
Yeah, absolutely. So in going after the hush wax, it started off very much as, okay, let's try and pull together that we do have. We have the policy documents, we have the memoirs, and we had an idea of just sort of writing, you know, doing a little bit of digging around, seeing what we could find, and then writing it up. However, we sort of got lucky, and the hush wax have this sort of slightly anomalous status, and this is similar with other wax working in other parts of the army, in that, because if you like, they're sort of segregated, they're living in separate accommodation, they're living in separate messes, and that means that they are sort of administered by the WAC organisation. So although they appear on the establishment tables of the Intelligence Corps, most of the day-to-day admin appears to have been done by the WACs. So we then sort of started digging around. We started digging around in the WAC war diaries. And we're quite lucky that the chief WAC administrator for Saint-Omer was incredibly diligent in recording people coming backwards and forwards in and out of her care, if you like.
Yeah.
We're also lucky because these women in the hushwax have sort of equivalent of junior officer status, so she records them by name. And so what we're able to see is pretty much their comings and goings, their arrivals. And then once you've got the name, then you can then start pursuing. And I was really quite lucky that I focused on the sort of policy documents and others then went deep into the genealogical research. And that then allowed us to pull together the Roll of Honour that now appears on the GCHQ website.
What's the 100th anniversary that we've just had?
That's the arrival of the hushwax.
It's their actual deployment.
The first six are the sort of test bed, if you like, I suppose, of the concept. And then over the sort of following 6 to 9 months, others are then sent out to sort of reinforce them in small batches. And there is a fairly haphazard recruitment process, which, looking back on it from 100 years, we sort of, you know, the sort of process by which, okay, well, you speak German,
yeah,
you're reasonably well educated. A number of them are already working in some sort of government capacity. So working in the censorship organization. By this stage in 1917, there are individuals within the war effort set up who are essentially personnel managers for intelligence. And you can sort of infer a process by which they speak to their chums in other departments saying, look, we're looking for women with who can speak German, can't really tell you what it's about. We will need to put them into uniform because we're deploying. So, you know, if you have, you know, a woman with German language skills and you wanted to go and work in Room 40 or you wanted to go and work in MI1B, she can do that as a civilian because it's in London. But if you're deploying them to France, you need them to be sort of subject to the rules and regulations of the army in France. So you then need to put them in uniform. So it's very hit and miss. And of course, famously in one of the memoirs, one of them records the fact that they have no idea what they're doing until they get to the office. And, you know, they are then told that they're going to be breaking German codes, which came as a bit of a shock. I mean, if we look at intelligence recruitment in 1914, it's very, very haphazard and very, very word of mouth. But I think by the time you get to 1917, if we look at the way in which, say, for example, men are being recruited into the intelligence corps, there is a fairly deliberate process, a series of interviews, background checks, you know. So I think there is an attempt to try and get round pegs for round holes in 1917. But because they're incredibly security conscious, they can't say what they're looking for. So they're going after the language skills. You know, essentially, it's the language skills which are the recruitment criteria. Whereas if they were clearer about what they were doing, they perhaps would be looking for other characteristics as well. But ultimately, it sort of works.
When they get to France, what kind of work are they doing? Do we know?
This, again, is one of the difficulties because the two memoirs are written immediately post-war and they are quite rightly, I suppose, very reticent about what they were sort of doing. But as with any of these sort of sources, you can make a number of assumptions. Now, in that regard, the memoirs are quite good in terms of giving us the colour of everyday life, the routines, the sort of the leisure activities, that sort of thing. But only really for a few paragraphs at the beginning do they talk about what they're doing and what we can sort of infer. And this is something which needs more digging, needs more work. And one of the difficulties that we run into is that we don't yet have a good handle on the men. I'm hoping that the research project that I'm involved in, that we will start to find out more about the men. If we take the memoir accounts, you've got the sort of the offices in the centre of Saint-Omer. You've got a mixture of junior army officers, again, with sort of eclectic educational backgrounds, perhaps clearly sort of have been recruited for their aptitude for this work. You then have NCOs, again, with some quite amusing and unusual backgrounds. And again, from inferring from one of the memoirs, obviously you've got different codes and cipher systems being used by different aspects of the Germans. So German aircraft are using a different system to the German army, etc. And so they have different teams, it would appear, attacking different aspects of the German communications. And what seems to happen is the Hushwacks themselves are then broken up into ones and twos and allocated to pre-existing teams. So in that regard, they're fully integrated. And what we also see, there's a couple of ones in the memoirs where they're sort of talking about the fact that after they've been doing this for a few weeks and a few months, they are actually able to come up with some solutions to some of the traffic themselves. But unfortunately, as I say, the sources are very, very limited. And so that is my interpretation of those sources. Yeah. Somebody else might read them and read something in completely differently.
How far from the front line were these ladies?
When they arrive in November 1917, Saint-Omer is designated as part of the lines of communication. So it's considered a safe area, except that by this stage, the Germans are conducting air raids on lines of communication areas. So the Hushwacks, on their, I think it's their second night, they
get a surprise.
They get a little bit of a surprise with the sort of bombing. But again, you get the impression that the bombing's pretty inaccurate. So everyone's fairly stoical about this, and they quickly become very stoical about it. And although they sort of emphasise the fact that this sort of unpleasant surprise of German bombing to begin with, it's just a sort of nuisance value after a while. Although, you know, one has to say that some of the bombings elsewhere in the lines of communications did get lucky from a German perspective and did kill troops and also WACs. So Saint-Omer is in danger from German aircraft, but it's not within German artillery range. But what happens in April 1918 is the Germans launch their second offensive and push the line back in the vicinity of Saint-Omer, which means that Saint-Omer is no longer considered lines of communication area, and so the Bureau is evacuated in stages to Paris-Plage on the coast. Now, this is interesting, and again, we can see this in the war diary of the WAC administrator, that the WACs are dispatched in small groups. They don't all lift up and move at one stage. Now, this, again, implies that what they're doing is moving the office by stages. So if we assume that the office has a number of individual sections doing different things, because at the time of the German offensives is the maximum time when you want to be able to break in their traffic. So in order to establish continuity, you're taking one section at a time and moving it to the coast until the whole office is there.
Some of these people actually go on to work at GCNCS, do they?
Yes. What you've got is a couple of them who go back to work at MI1B, and then there's another one who goes on to then work with, once MI1B merges with Room 40, goes on to work with them. But again, none of them go on to have a lengthy career. No. But again, given the sort of status of women within the organisation, that's not necessarily entirely surprising. We're going to keep digging. I'm involved in a project funded through the Arts and Humanities Research Council. It's a project which I'm undertaking with the Military Intelligence Museum, with volunteers from the Military Intelligence Museum, to look at the Intelligence Corps in the First World War. And we're sort of, it's work in progress at the moment.
I think we'll have to have you back on the podcast when you've delved a bit deeper then.
Indeed. Big pleasure.
Award-winning author Claire Mully has been delving into stories of women who risked their lives during World War II on both sides. She has a new book out about women who flew for Hitler. She's been talking to podcast producer Mark Cotton.
So you've told stories in your last two books of three different women.
Yeah, they're all very, very different women. My book for last was called The Spy Who Laughed, and it's a biography of Christina Scarbeck, a.k.a. Christine Granville, who was the first woman to work for Britain as a special agent in the Second World War. So Christina was a Polish countess and a great Polish patriot. And she wasn't actually in Poland when Nazi Germany invaded in September 1939. She was married to a diplomat and they were on their way to a posting in Southern Africa. And when they heard the terrible news, they immediately tried to find out how they could best serve their country. And they decided to come back as quickly as they could. But by the time they got back to Europe, Poland had been occupied. Poland never capitulated. They had a government in exile, which originally went to France and then came to London. And so both she and her husband decided to volunteer and serve them. And it's a wonderful story, actually, because Christine came into Southampton, and within a couple of days, she is banging on the door of the headquarters of the British Secret Services, which, of course, nobody's meant to know where that address is. So she obviously had her contacts. Yeah. And we can only imagine the look on the faces of the guys inside as this Polish patriot came in full of passion, determined to do her bit. Because first of all, to work for the British Secret Services, you have to be British. And she was Polish. Yeah. And then, above all, she was female. And this was long before, almost 2 years before any other women were recruited. And yet, she is so brilliant. She has the languages. She speaks French perfectly, pretty good English. She obviously speaks Polish. She speaks a bit of other languages as well. She has the contact. She's very well connected in Warsaw. She got people across Poland that she knows. She's got people over here. And she's got the courage, but above all, she knows how to get in and out of Poland, because when she was a rather bored Polish countess earlier, she used to smuggle cigarettes across the border over the high Tatra mountains on her skis, not because she needed the money or anything. She just did it for kicks. So she knew the smuggling route. She knew the Goral people, the mountain people. And so she knew how to get in and out as well. And they had to use her. She actually worked in three different theatres of the war, but her first work was going across the mountains. She was based in Budapest with a British alibi and so on. And she took her first journey across that winter in conditions of minus 20 degrees, incredibly difficult, and made contact with the fledgling Polish resistance, which was just getting organised, and managed to bring back the first sort of idea of how troop movements were being organised in Poland, how the occupying forces were working. So really useful work. And that was just sort of the precursor of her work, really. She went on and served in Egypt and the Middle East. And then her most famous work, the work that made her legendary within the British Special Forces, was when she was parachuted behind enemy lines in occupied France in July 1944. So she wasn't just the first woman to work in that role. She was also the longest serving female special agent of the war. And although she was very highly honoured, her story was pretty much covered up after the war. And it was wonderful to be able to research it, interview people and bring that story back to us.
So you go from someone that we can obviously see as a heroine, but your next book, two very different women.
Yes. Well, there is a rich seam of women's stories which are yet to be told. And it's wonderful to write the story of a heroine. And it was absolutely fantastic and inspiring. And talking to these people, it was really exciting. And I felt it was a real honour as well as an adventure to write her story. But I don't want to just coast on the stories of these heroines. I wanted to do something. I wanted to understand more about the war. I decided to try and look at a story from the other side. So this is not to glorify in any sense. This is trying to work out how did Hitler manage to corral these different resources in his country to support his appalling ends. I'd heard a bit about Hannah Reich, who is the more famous of my two Nazi test pilots. She wrote her own story, had her memoirs published after the war. She actually had different versions of them done. And the little edits, the changes are quite interesting to look at. Anyhow, she respun her story. And her story's really been told on her terms. And so even recently, there have been a couple of biographies and they present her as being a brilliant pilot, which she absolutely was. Yeah. Amazing pilot. Very courageous. No question about her blunt courage. But generally apolitical, or you're just not interested, and almost could have been a heroine on the other side. She was born over here. And it was fascinating to dig down a little bit. And one of the resources I found was an archive of someone who had some letters that she had written later on after the war, which show a very different perspective on her character. So she was deeply anti-Semitic. She never, after the war, ever reevaluated her loyalties or looked at the regime or criticised it. And it was very interesting to see that she was absolutely in denial. She chose willingly to look the other way, and that balance hadn't been given to her story. So I was interested in that.
This is the woman who, days before Hitler dies, flies into Berlin, doesn't she, to try and rescue him.
This is one of the most famous stories about her, and it's an incredible story. So she was brought in by Robert Ritter von Greim, who she was very close friends with. And Hitler had asked him to come into Berlin when it was surrounded by the Red Army to receive last orders. And he knew that one of the craft to take them in from an outside airport right into central Berlin, the best thing to use would be an early helicopter. And Hannah was the first woman to fly a helicopter, first person actually to fly a helicopter inside a building. Yeah. Quite extraordinary. So he brought her in to help. When they got to the airfield, the helicopter had been destroyed anyhow. So he was going to leave her and fly in on his own. But she wormed her way into the fuselage without telling him and came in to a closer airport. And then they stopped and they're going to have to do the last hop. So they got to the next airport and they only had a small plane. So they flew in a Fizzler Storch, which is really a reconnaissance plane. And she was behind him behind his seat. And as they came into Berlin, the Red Army anti-aircraft guns shot up and one of the bullets went through the nose of the plane and also went into Richard von Grimm's legs. He slumped unconscious from blood loss and Hannah had to lean over his shoulders to land this aircraft, the story is, on the main east-west axis Berlin.
It's in front of the Brandenburg Gate, isn't it?
It is. The wreck was there and the photographs of it, you know, later when the Americans have got this plane, there you can see it. And she dragged him out of the aircraft and got him to the bunker and he was treated by Hitler's surgeon, Stumpfegger. And you know, Hitler greeted them saying, there's some loyalty in the world and gave her a present, which was a cyanide tablet. And so they spent a couple of days there and left. She begged him, apparently, to come out with her and he refused. And she flew out with Richard von Grimm taking last orders and various other things out, including Eva Braun's last letter, which she read. She shouldn't have read it, but she was very dismissive about it. She didn't really rate Eva Braun and she threw it out the window, so we don't have that.
But you didn't just tell her story. You did an amazing thing. You found, I think, someone who really was the absolute opposite.
Much said I don't want to tell just the story of heroines, I didn't want to just tell Hannah's story. This is not about glorifying in any way. I wanted to put it in context and balance. And I was fortunate enough to come across the story of another woman whose story was pretty much unknown over here. Her name was Melita Schiller. And she and Hannah actually learnt to glide over the same green slopes in there.
They were slightly different ages, weren't they?
Yeah, Melita was 9 years older. So they had very different perspectives as well. Melita was informed by the First World War and Hannah was informed by, you know, rising.
Growing up in Nazi Germany.
Yeah. In some senses, they're very similar. They were both great patriots. They both had a strong sense of courage and duty. And they were both brilliant, brilliant pilots. So brilliant that the Nazi regime, who really saw this as a very male field, needed them, didn't just want them, but needed them to do this test work. And Melita also was an aeronautical engineer and absolutely brilliant. And so her role was developing the Stuka dive bombers. And she not only developed them herself, she developed things like the bomb sites, but she also then went into the field and did the test work in them. So testing dive bombs in prototype machines.
Thousands and thousands of tests.
Yeah, over 2,000 during the course of the war. You know, for a lot of people died in the test programme. So a man doing a test dive, he did more than one, was considered, you know, heroic, really. Melita would do up to 15 a day. Mm. Extraordinary work. No one else could do it. Nazis being Nazis looked for a biological explanation. They started wondering if women's blood content was different or something. They had to justify it in those terms. But she justified it another way. The reason she was doing it was because, we don't know exactly when, but possibly in 1935, when the Nuremberg laws came in, which enshrined racial discrimination in German law, she found out that her father's father had been born Jewish and she was considered Mischling. That's half their Jewish, term, yeah. Half-blood, yeah. And so she applied for equal to Aryan status, not just for herself. In fact, she was granted it herself, but she refused it. She said she'd only take it if it was for all of her family. And so she knew that she had to make herself uniquely valuable to the regime for them to consider this. Very few people were given this status. So she was saving her family. But that wasn't enough for her.
No. People would probably have more of an idea of her if you mention her married name.
Yes. So Melita married into an old German family. She loved her husband, but I'm sure that marrying into that family was partly as well about trying to Germanify her. And it was useful for him as well. She married a man called Alexander von Stauffenberg, and he was the elder brother of Klaus von Stauffenberg, who is famous, of course, for the Valkyrie bomb plot and proposed coup afterwards. Probably the most famous attempt on Hitler's life. Sadly, of course, not successful. So she was very close to Klaus. And one of the wonderful things when you look at some of these women's stories is that there are new sources that haven't been looked at. People haven't looked with those eyes and they haven't researched around them so much. And so even on something as famous as the bomb plot, we managed to find new resources. One of the things that I found, I got in touch with Melita's family, who very kindly opened up their drawers and so on, is her 1943-1944 handwritten diary. It's an incredible resource. And it actually, you know, we've got entries for the 20th of July, 1944. Yes. And what we found was that Melita was very close to Klaus. She had been providing a safe place for him to meet people involved in the plot. Because she was a pilot, she had access to use a yacht on the Wannsee Lake in Berlin. And nobody could bug them there. So it was a very safe place for conversation. Yeah. So there was a lot of them going sailing increasingly as we run up towards July. And then in the weeks and the days beforehand, she's increasingly staying over in his Tristanstrasse flat, which is basically conspirators HQ. She's there actually just two nights before the plot. And we found out that she had offered to fly Klaus to the assassination attempt at the Vault Slayer and bring him back again. But she couldn't get the right plane on the day. And so that didn't happen. But she was very involved in the conspiracy.
You couldn't have found two women more opposite ends of the spectrum, could you?
Both pilots, both patriots, but with a very different sense of what that patriotism meant. Mm. One of them's a fanatical Nazi, the other one supports the old sort of Junker values, a different, the Germany of Schiller, and one of them tries to save Hitler. The other one is involved in the most famous attempt on his life. And yet these women knew each other throughout the war. The only two women who were pilots socialising at the Berlin Air Club. The only two working from the same airfields and yet ended their lives on opposite sides of history. It's an extraordinary opportunity to look at all sorts of things like the roles that could be available to women in Nazi Germany, the limited choices, gender and technology, all of these things which haven't been looked through that prism before.
The Germans didn't put the women to work, did they? But then you get this other side where...
They're almost honorary men, these two. Melita certainly considers herself an honorary man. One of the ironies is that Hannah, who is the fanatical supporter of the regime, was a bit of a feminist, and she's very critical of the men. Obviously, both of them experienced a huge amount of sexism and resistance to their work. She calls in the big shots and gets to fly whatever she wants. Whereas Melita is not. She's sort of old conservative values. She's not a racist, but she's not a feminist. And the one talk that she gave that we have the manuscript of it, at one point she says, you know, we female pilots are not suffragettes. So it's quite nice that we don't have a goodie who's completely good and a baddie who's, well, I mean, she's pretty bad. But they're complex individuals. Mm. This is not a black and white story. It's not about good Nazis or bad women. It's about real women in difficult circumstances, nevertheless making very strong moral choices, and they made different ones, and it's an important story for them.
But I think that's the thing about telling women's stories, because we've had 70 plus years of male-based history, haven't we? And now we're getting to tell these stories of women, and we're getting a different history, aren't we? We're getting a different take on history, and I think that's what's so important. Is that what draws you to writing about women?
Yeah. Some of that is, I think, especially when you look at even the heroine, like the women in SOE, you tend to see them presented as very courageous and, you know, plucky. And they went in and they did the best job they could and they were very beautiful. And you don't hear so much that they went in, they did the same job as men. They were trained the same, armed the same, put in the front line or behind enemy lines alongside the men. They were put in for a slightly different job, mainly to be couriers, which men did as well. But several of them ended up, like Pearl Witherington or Nancy Wake, leading armies of men, both French and deputy officers underneath them who were men. And so really, they were leading armies. You know, and these stories haven't been told. What hasn't been told is that these women were really effective and they made a very significant contribution to the war effort, not just that they tried hard and were plucky. So it's good to be able to restore the balance on the effectiveness of the female special agents. There are other stories that are told, but we're still missing quite a lot, you know. It was very interesting. Recently, the RAF become the first part of the British military to open all jobs to female applicants. The last job that had been opened up that has made that piece of history is women in combat roles with the RAF, but on the ground in combat roles supporting the bases. And of course, there was a huge furore about it because women aren't as strong and it will lead to this, that and the other. But if women aren't as strong, they still have to pass the same fitness test. Exactly. If you pass that fitness test, male or female, you are presumably fit for the job and so on. So there doesn't need to be a gender discrimination. That's still happening today. And if you look at the lens through which we've looked at women's history, you hardly know that women were actually in combat roles. In the Second World War, they were out there doing the same work. So, yes, it is important these stories are retold and they still have huge contemporary relevance.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.